to your company while I paint. I don't need others. I have you, I have Malcolm, I have the business, and I have my art. It is a good life." Her look of affection filled me.
"How fortunate I am to have you," she said.
"And I you," I said. And the next few years passed quietly. Though Delia remained in the household, we seldom saw each other. And while she kept a wide berth of me, so too did I of her. In the early spring of 1822, Mrs. Burton, against my objections, began to plan a celebration of my birthday.
"Dearest, you are going to be 25 years old. At this rate, I will never see a grandchild. It is time you met a young lady, and it appears that it is up to me to provide the opportunity," she said.
Although her comment was said in a light-hearted way, it was not the first time she had expressed a desire for me to carry on the Burton name. I felt some guilt whenever this subject came up. Naturally, I had not told her that marriage for me was not a consideration. Given my ancestry, I would never chance having a child. I remembered well when, during one of my last years at Tall Oaks, the wife of a nearby plantation owner gave birth to a baby with negroid features. When it was learned that a light-skinned house servant was the father, it was rumored that the child was murdered, and in despair, the mother took her own life. That scandal happened when my grandmother's sister, Mrs. Madden, was visiting from Williamsburg, and her adamant declaration had stayed with me. "It only proves that no matter how light-skinned they might be, Negro blood will always show through." How credible her comment was, I did not know, but I had no intention of testing it. However, I agreed to the birthday celebration. I had noted during the long winter that Mrs. Burton's spirits appeared to be flagging, and I hoped that a small gathering would give her something to look forward to. But the planning had no sooner begun than Robert was taken very ill with fever, and everything came to an abrupt halt. Because of the yellow fever epidemic that had taken her son, Mrs. Burton feared the worst and begged me to keep my distance from Robert's sickbed. I did so for 2 days, but finally went to visit, hoping to find him improved. Instead, I found food and water set outside Robert's door, where he was too ill to access it. Inflamed, I strode to the kitchen where I found Delia.
"Are you ill?"
I demanded.
"No,"
she said.
"Then why are you not seeing to Robert?"
"I don't take care of those with no fever. I see how that boy of Mr. and Mrs. Burton die. No, sir, I don't have nothing to do with no fever."
"But you must. He needs care."
"No, I don't go in there,"
she said, staring me down. I left to arrange for a nurse. But the rage I had suppressed toward Delia these past years was back in full blossom. Daily, I checked to ensure that Robert was cared for until he began to recover. The morning I found him sitting up in a chair, he asked the nurse to leave so he and I might be alone together. "What is it?" I moved my chair closer to him.
"Where is Delia? Why is she not caring for me?" Robert asked.
"She refused. She said she wouldn't care for anyone with a fever."
His eyebrows shot up.
"She refused? And you were required to hire someone in?"
"I had no choice." He shook his head.
"She goes too far."
I saw my opportunity.
"I don't trust her. I never have. I know you depend on her, but I would like her to be dismissed."
"It is Mrs. Burton who depends on her. I would be happy to see her leave," he said.
Now my eyes opened in surprise. "If you agree, I would be happy to speak to Mrs. Burton about discharging her," I said. Robert looked toward the closed door before he leaned forward to speak quietly.
"On my arrival, Delia was already employed with the Burtons. She resented my taking over the household and went to Mrs. Burton with a rumor that regrettably followed me from Europe."
He leaned his forehead on the tips of his long fingers and closed his eyes. After a long minute, he straightened to look at me.
"The rumor was true, but fortunately the Burtons were open-minded. On the promise that I would give no further cause for gossip, they kept me on."
Robert, too, had secrets, and such a damaging one that the Burtons might have dismissed this wonderful man. What a relief to know that I wasn't alone in this. His candor gave me the courage to speak more openly about Delia.
"I don't trust her. Years ago, she stole something from my room."
His dark brown eyes looked at me carefully.
"Why didn't you tell Mr. and Mrs. Burton?"
My face grew hot. It involves my past, I said. It would have been upsetting to them.
I see, he said, avoiding my eyes as he smoothed the blanket that covered his lap. I should have told you this before. Years ago, I overheard a conversation wherein Delia told Ed that she had information, damaging information, about you. Ed was upset and made her promise to stay quiet.
Weren't you concerned? I asked. Didn't you wonder what it was about?
Robert met my eyes. I knew that you did not mean to harm the Burtons. In fact, you brought this household back to life. And Mr. Burton died in peace because of you.
My gratitude to him brought tears to my eyes.
Thank you, Robert, I said.
I am not an innocent, Robert said. We all carry burdens from our past, but it is not for others to exploit them.
I breathed in deeply. It felt as though a large weight had been lifted off my shoulders. For the first time since Delia's theft, I felt some measure of relief. Now I knew I had Robert's support. As soon as you are well, I will see to it that Delia is removed, I said. It is my responsibility.
I will leave it to you, then, he said. But tread carefully. She can be ruthless.
I waited until Robert was back in good health before I sought Delia out. On an early morning before I left for work, I startled her just as she was sitting down to enjoy a cup of coffee. I would like you to give my letter back, I said, approaching her.
I don't know what you's talking about, she said, setting down her cup with careful precision on the weathered table.
I glared at her. The letter that you stole from me years ago, it is mine and I want you to give it back to me. She stood up hurriedly and began to gather the morning dishes.
I never say nothing to nobody. I don't know why you coming at me like this now.
I want that letter back. It is mine. My hands clenched in fury.
Deal, you don't got no letter.
Then where is it? I asked.
She never do have no letter, she said, continuing to stack the dishes.
You are lying. I grabbed her wrist and sent a blue and white saucer spinning to the floor. I said I want it back now. She jerked her arm free and backed away.
That letter makes sure I stay in this house. You best forget about it.
You will regret this, I said. And inflamed, I turned to go while I still had control of myself. That day I was useless at work. I spent the bulk of the morning pacing. How should I proceed? Did she still have the letter or had she gotten rid of it? When I dismissed her, what might she do? Would she go to Mrs. Burton? I left for home in the early afternoon, deciding to go directly to Mrs. Burton and tell her that Delia must leave. However, on my arrival, I didn't find Mrs. Burton resting in her room, where I had expected her to be. Instead, I found her sitting with Malcolm in Mr. Burton's room.
"Oh, Jamie," she greeted me with reddened eyes. "You are home. I didn't know if I should send for you. I don't know what to do."
"Greetings! Greetings!"
Malcolm shouted in Robert's clipped accent, then flew across to sit on my shoulder. He clung there as I pulled up a chair next to Mrs. Burton. "I am home now. All is well." I took her hand as she began to weep.
"Tell me," I said, "what is the trouble?"
"I promised Delia."
"Promised her what? There is nothing you can't tell me."
"It involves you. You wouldn't believe.
You know Delia has resented me ever since I came here as a young boy."
"But she said that you mean to harm her."
Malcolm nipped my ear, and for the first time I smacked at his beak. He squawked in surprise and flew off to perch at the window. I loosened my damp collar and leaned back in the chair.
"Harm her? And why would I do that?"
"She said that she had read a letter of yours. Of course, I asked her immediately if you had given her permission to do so, but she did not reply and went on to say that she fears you will make her leave."
"And this supposed letter," I said, "did she mention the contents?"
"Oh, the accusation she made was so vicious that I am reluctant to repeat it. She accused you of... Oh, it is too ugly. Really, Jamie, I prefer not to say."
"Please tell me," I said.
"But I promised."
"I must know the slander so I might address it," I said, gripping the arms of the chair while fighting to stay calm.
"Oh, dear boy, let us forget it," she said, seeing my growing fury. It is really too ridiculous to repeat something so outrageous.
Please let us get this over with, I demanded.
She said that you were a Negro, she blurted out.
I leaned over to brush some supposed dirt from my pant leg, needing the time to steady my breath. After I straightened again, I gave a short laugh. She's off her head, I said. I held up my hands, then turned them over to expose my palms. Which part of me, exactly, does she suggest is Negro?
I know how foolish this must sound to you, but she held to it so strongly that it was most upsetting.
Surely you couldn't have entertained, I said, moving to the edge of my seat.
James, of course not. I could never believe such a thing. Please, do not take offense. I don't believe any of it. You, a Negro, it is impossible.
Anger suddenly took over. Was her love for me so limited that my tainted blood would destroy it? Dreading the answer, I could not contain the question. And if I were? If it were true, what would it mean to you if I said I was a Negro? An unmistakable look of revulsion crossed her face as she shook her head.
But it isn't possible, she said.
So you would no longer care for me? I asked, rising from my chair. My worst fear was true.
James! Jamie, dear, she said. Please sit.
But she had given herself away, and I could not stop. What upsets me is that you will not answer me, to think that you would not care for me if... I couldn't breathe. That her love was conditioned on my race struck me so profoundly that I could not take in air. She called out to me as I fled the room and left for the outdoors. My thoughts circled, and I noted nothing as I walked for hours that warm mid-May afternoon. What should I do? Should I tell her the truth? But what was the truth? Would I call myself a Negro? Surely there was not enough Negro blood in me that I should be cast as one of them. Nor was I one of them. How many times had Grandmother pointed out what a lesser race they were? So eager to be taken care of, so willing to be subservient. How many times had I heard of their non-existent morals? They thought nothing of bedding each other and producing offspring they abandoned. And they were a thieving people, as evidenced by Delia taking my letter. How could I be one of them? Nothing in me fit the description. I carried none of their traits. I was not one of them. Yet I could not forget that look of disgust on Mrs. Burton's face. Twice I ran to an alley to empty my stomach when it heaved at the remembrance. Why could she not love me as I was, Negro or no? I had loved her as I loved my own dear grandmother. How wrenching it was to think of leaving this safe and beloved home, but by nightfall I had come to the sickening conclusion that I had no other choice. I was exhausted when I returned to the house and there went straight to my rooms. I had just pulled out my leather bag, but before I had a chance to begin packing, Robert came with a note that bore Mrs. Burton's seal. After Robert left, I opened the note.
Delia has been asked to leave this house. I beg your forgiveness for questioning you about her slanderous accusations. The subject is forgotten. You have my word that I will never doubt you again.
I sat with the note long into the night, unable to make a decision. In the early morning, Robert came to tell me that Delia had been put out of the house, and Mrs. Burton was waiting to see me. I went then, terrified of the task at hand. I found her seated in a chair beside her bed, still dressed in her night clothes. She looked so frail and shaken, so frightened and alone, yet I knew what I had to do. At the very least, she deserved to hear the truth. I went to her chair and knelt by her side. I tore free my eye patch, wanting her to see all of me. Her hand trembled when she smoothed the ridge on my face that my eye patch had made. My head pounded and tears burned my eyes. "I must tell you," I began. Her hand slipped down to cover my mouth.
"No," she said. "We shall never speak of this again. Let us leave it at that."
In relief, I dropped my head in her lap and wept, while she soothed me as a mother might her son. But the damage had been done, and because the truth was never addressed, it festered like a thorn. Where before Mrs. Burton and I were easy and relaxed around each other, now our relationship was strained, and while she became more solicitous, I, in my guilt and need, grew more distant. Though I was years into my art study with Mr. Leeds, I continued on as my passion for the work grew. Malcolm's room overflowed with watercolors, miniatures mainly, that covered every surface and were pinned to every wall. Birds were my main focus, but now I painted flora and fauna as well. I had become so adept at miniatures that Mr. Leeds suggested I consider creating a small handbook, such as Bartram's, for amateur botanists. However, to undertake this task, travel such as Mr. Bartram had done would be required of me, and with the silver business and the responsibility of Mrs. Burton, I did not see it as a possibility. Over the years, Mr. Leeds had become a friend to both Mrs. Burton and me, and he proved a pleasant distraction. On Sunday afternoon, it became habit that following my art instruction, he joined us for tea. Lemon-glazed pound cake was a favorite of his, so it was always served, and we were then assured of his entertaining company until the last of the cake was gone. Thus, Mrs. Burton and I were dismayed to learn later that summer that Mr. Leeds was facing health issues and must abruptly end his teaching. "I would like you to take over a small class that I teach in my home," he said to me. "The students could benefit from what I have taught you." "But I am not qualified. I know so little." He laughed aloud. "I believe that some would say otherwise," he said, referring to the two sales I had made recently. They were small pinfeather renderings and had sold for quite a sum. "I think teaching would benefit you as well," he added. "Is it a watercolor class? Would the students be using sable brushes?" "Of course." "What, you thought I meant that you should teach them to work with a pinfeather? Good luck to find students with that kind of talent." "Why don't you consider it, James?" Mrs. Burton asked enthusiastically. "You could hold the classes where you do your work now, up in Malcolm's room. It is large enough, and it would be nice to bring new life into this house." And so, because it offered Mrs. Burton and me a further distraction on a Sunday afternoon, I accepted. I was right to do so, for the art classes proved a boon for our strained relationship. My adopted mother knew many of the students' families, and their family histories were often a topic of conversation for us. In time, we grew more comfortable again with each other, though we never did recover the intimacy we once had, for neither of us could cross the divide. She, who needed to deny the truth, and I, who longed to have her accept it and love me for it. There is one deep regret I carry from that time. On a number of occasions, Mrs. Burton asked me to clear out Mr. Burton's rooms and to take them as my own, but I always declined. Was I punishing her, or did I not want to feel more the imposter than I already did? I still do not have the answer. However, when Robert came to me on September 4, 1824, to tell me that Mrs. Burton had unexpectedly passed away during the night, I was grief-stricken. I had loved her as a mother, and though she had put forth her best effort to love me as a son, a difference existed after she learned the truth from Delia. Yet I did not hold her responsible. How could I blame her for an inability to love the part of me that I, too, loathed?
Chapter 15 1824 to 1828 James. Though I had inherited everything and the house was mine, months passed before Robert could persuade me to move down to Mr. Burton's quarters. I knew the sense of it, but I felt an intruder and relented only after Robert convinced me how much easier it would be for the household staff to serve me. When we went down to look over Mr. Burton's rooms, I wondered aloud if the house was perhaps too large and too elegant for me. Robert frowned. "And why would you not be suited for this home? The Burtons chose you as their son, and as their heir you must claim it." Because he believed it, I tried to convince myself to do the same. The winter was long and lonely, and I spent so much time at work that I grew weary of it all. Then, in the spring of 1825, a woman swept through the door of my silver shop and demanded to see the proprietor. Nicholas summoned me from my back office, where I had been looking over the accounts. After Christmas, work had fallen off. And though I knew I should find a way to encourage more business, with both Mr. and Mrs. Burton gone, building the business no longer interested me. When I came out, I immediately recognized the visitor. "Mrs. Carden," I exclaimed in surprise and walked around to greet her. I had met this socially prominent woman through Mr. Leeds, a longtime friend of the Cardens. It was she who had purchased the two paintings of mine.
"You remember me," she said with a smile.
"How could I not?" I said, pleased to see her. In the past 2 years, we had met twice at Bartram's expansive gardens. I remembered well her casual demeanor and light-hearted ways, which put me at ease. Because she was 20 years or so my senior, her teasing was less threatening than had she been of my age, and she laughed gaily when I uncharacteristically quipped in response to her repartee. Now, as she gave a quick look about the shop, she let slip from her shoulders a patterned paisley shawl to expose a green day dress that snugly fit her comely figure. When she abruptly turned back, one of the many feathers from her large-brimmed hat dislodged, and we both watched it slowly float to the floor. I picked up the wayward adornment, blew it free of any dust, and presented it to her with a flourish. "Madam, your feather," I said.
"Oh, you may keep it," she said, laughing, "as a memento of my first visit here."
I followed her lead and placed the feather in my waistcoat pocket, then patted it. "I shall treasure this always," I said, smiling as I gave a small bow. She laughed again and tapped my arm with her fan, then tilted her head as she studied me.
"So, James Burton," she said, "I've been hearing rumors about you."
"You have?" I asked, and when my heart gave a sudden thud, I brushed at an imaginary spot of dust on the display case. "Are they at least interesting?"
"Well, certainly. One involves a duel," she teased.
Surprised at her reference, I involuntarily touched my eye patch, then saw I had embarrassed her. I planted my feet firmly and deepened my voice. "Mrs. Carden, the rumor is false. I did not lose my eye in a duel. In actuality, it was such a spectacular event that I am afraid I have forgotten the details." She laughed and tapped my arm again with her fan. But before she could continue, I spoke. "No, I'm afraid that you will find all of the rumors are false. Naturally, you will not be surprised to learn that I have heard rumors about you as well."
"Oh, I am sure that you have," she said. "But mine are all true."
We laughed together.
"You were fun," she said. "You must come to some of our evenings. Rumor has it," she said, offering a sly smile, "that you are quite reclusive."
"Yes, I will concede that is true. Mrs. Burton was an invalid, and I didn't want to leave her," I explained.
"I was sorry to hear of her passing," she said.
"Thank you. I miss her a great deal."
"Well, then, I must introduce you to my friends."
"I would be pleased to have you do so," I replied, knowing full well the significance. At the least, here was my answer to my business dilemma. Many were competing in the silver trade, and a client such as Mrs. Carden would mean not only survival to my silver shop, but added prestige as well. Many times I had heard the Burtons speak of Mrs. Carden and the power she wielded. In this large city of Philadelphia, the topmost echelon of aristocracy included only families who could trace their lineage back to the earliest Quaker settlers. They considered themselves an exclusive group and denied entry into their tight circle to those of new wealth. As a consequence, socially aspiring merchants and businessmen, those who had more recently acquired their fortunes, developed their own elite society, and it was headed by none other than Mrs. Randolph Carden. Now she stood before me in my shop. There was a pause as she again looked about. "Might I show you something?" I asked.
"Actually, I came with a specific request. I have seen some of your vinaigrettes, and I would like you to craft one for my daughter. But it must be exclusive. It is a gift for her 18th birthday."
"Do you have a particular design in mind?" I asked. "What are her interests?"
"Well, she likes to paint. Oh, and she is interested in anything that has to do with birds. She has a parakeet that she dotes on."
"She likes birds?" I asked.
"Yes," she answered.
I thought for a moment. "I have an idea," I said, "but it will take time and the cost of the finished piece might be..."
Her hand brushed the air, dismissing my concern. The cost is incidental, but you must complete it within 4 weeks so she will have it for her birthday.
I will have it done for you, I said.
Don't disappoint me, she warned.
Each week, Mrs. Carden dropped in to ask about my progress. Because of our light flirtation, it was always a pleasure to see her. But the day she arrived for the completed piece, she bore a more subdued air. I invited her into my office, a small room made smaller by the oak roll-top desk that took up a quarter of the space. The cleaning woman had left the room in good order and smelling of fresh lemon, so I seated Mrs. Carden there before I hurried off to retrieve the package. On my return, she was holding a miniature painting of Malcolm that had been propped on my desk.
"You painted this?" she asked.
"I did," I said.
"It is exquisite. Would you allow me to purchase it? You know how I love the others that I purchased."
But I was impatient. "Before we discuss that, I would like to show you this. Come," I said, waving her over to the window, where I opened the small blue box in the sunlight. As I knew it would, the tiny silver parakeet gleamed against the dark blue velvet, and the small ruby in the eye of the bird sparkled. Mrs. Carden gasped as she lifted it from the box, then opened the bird's miniature wing to expose the ornamental grill.
"Oh, Mr. Burton, it is beautiful! Caroline will love this!"
"Do you think so?" I asked, enjoying her pleasure.
"Oh, yes, she will."
When she caught my smile, her eyes filled.
"What is it?" I asked, concerned at her sudden change of mood.
"Forgive me," she whispered, handing the silver piece back to me before reaching into her soft leather reticule for a handkerchief.
I went over and closed the office door.
"Please sit," I said. "You must be forthright. Do you not like the piece?"
"Oh, no, no, I love it. My problem is, that is, it is more personal."
She glanced at the closed door. "What you tell me will not leave this room," I assured her.
"You give me your word? It will stay between the two of us?" she asked.
"Certainly," I answered.
"Just this morning, as I dressed to come here, Mr. Carden informed me that he had finalized arrangements for Caroline's marriage," she said.
She looked at me, her eyes pained.
"The match is wrong, all wrong, but he is insisting on it."
"You do not approve of the young man?" I asked, trying to better understand.
"I do not, and neither will Caroline."
Bitterness coated her words. "Can she not refuse?"
"Refuse? Caroline?
No one refuses Mr. Carden, least of all his daughter."
"And your husband has no regard for your opinion?"
She looked at me in disbelief.
"My opinion? His opinion is our opinion. It is as simple as that," she said.
With her elbow on the arm of the chair, she leaned her head into her hand.
"This marriage will destroy my daughter's life."
I tried for words of comfort. "But at least she will be here with you in Philadelphia," I reminded her.
"No," she said, staring up at me with stricken eyes. "They are to go abroad. For 2 years. It is part of the arrangement. The boy's father wants him to travel, and my daughter is to go with him."
"I see," I said. She turned on me.
"No, no, you don't see. The boy is already a ruin, and this is my only child, my only daughter. Can you understand what this means to me? What it will mean to her?"
She looked so lost that I rested my hand on her shoulder, then quickly removed it. "I do," I said. "I do understand."
"Oh, dear."
She straightened her shoulders as she struggled to collect herself.
"I am sorry, so sorry, to have burdened you with this."
I was struck at her difficult position and wanted to console her, but I could find no words. I rose and went for the small painting of Malcolm. "I want you to have this," I said, handing it to her. "It is my gift to you."
"Oh."
She stood when she reached for it and held it to her bosom.
"How dear of you."
"I only want to see you smile again," I said, but realized too late the intimacy those words invited when she stepped close and placed her hand on my arm.
"Am I to understand?" she asked, her voice soft and inviting. "Perhaps next Wednesday afternoon? I'm free."
I
I stumbled over words as I tried to re-establish a boundary. I wish I had the time, but I'm afraid my days are taken up with work. As though on cue, my pocket watch pinged, marking the hour.
Of course, she said, pulling back her hand. You are busy. How foolish of me to think otherwise. Naturally.
She laughed lightly as she busied herself and tucked her handkerchief away. I'm sorry, I said, knowing that I had insulted her. Perhaps dinner?
Certainly, she said. I shall send you a dinner invitation. You must meet my husband.
It would be my pleasure, I said, hating the distance now between us. Before she left, she opened her reticule.
You have created two pieces of art, she said. Now tell me, what does my husband owe you? I will always consider the painting a gift, but I must insist he pay for both.
Long before I received my first invitation to Mrs. Carden's home, friends of hers began to frequent my silver shop. These were women of enormous wealth who were not opposed to spending extravagantly, and because of them, the silver business again flourished. That autumn, when an invitation arrived from Mrs. Carden, I was happy for the distraction, for my own home was a lonely place. I missed Mrs. Burton more than I could have anticipated, and sometimes, in my loneliness, I visited her rooms with Malcolm. There I sat at her bedside, fingering the books we once read aloud to one another, while Malcolm flew about distractedly. Usually, though, he did not settle, and we would have to leave when he, in his frustration at not finding her, would chew at the engraved bedposts. I had come to dread the solitary meals served in the large dining room, until Robert suggested I take them in the small back parlor. There, in a more intimate setting, Malcolm and the crackling of a small fire gave me some company while I ate. I looked forward to teaching my Sunday art students, not only for the company they provided, but for the stimuli of my own artwork. Many evenings I found solace in painting as I worked to perfect the technique of using a pin feather, often dreaming of the day I might travel and create a small handbook similar to Bartram's. I did not see Mrs. Carden after our last meeting at the silver shop, but throughout the summer I heard through her friends about her daughter's extravagant wedding. In the fall, Mrs. Carden sent me an invitation for a dinner. Though a month away, it presented a dilemma, as it included an evening of dance, a skill I had not yet learned. After Robert made some discreet inquiries, he found a dance master who agreed to come to my home and teach me not only how to dance, but also the required etiquette of the ballroom. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed the exercise. The dance master's handsome young wife laughed as we giddily circled the room. I prefer the waltz to any of the other dances, I called out above the music, enjoying the easy rhythm and liking the idea of having only one partner. The dance master suddenly stopped playing the spinet that Robert had moved from the back parlor into the more spacious front parlor. It is not good form to hold your partner that close, my instructor sniffed. And though the waltz is done at Mrs. Carden's affairs, you will not find it so in the more conservative ballrooms. The intimacy of it is considered quite scandalous, he said, glaring first at his pink-faced wife and then at me over his spectacles. I arrived at the Carden's home that first evening to find I already knew some of the other guests, as they were now my customers. Nonetheless, Mrs. Carden took my arm and introduced me around, and though her voice remained cheerful, her hand stiffened when we came to her husband.
Mr. Carden, this is the young man I was telling you about. He is the artist, the silversmith artist, James Burton. Do you recall me speaking to you of him?
I certainly recall his bill, he said. He laughed then as though to dismiss the insult, and when his repeated glance at my eye patch alerted me to his curiosity, I ignored it, knowing with some satisfaction that good manners prevented him from asking the question he most wanted answered. Dinner went by smoothly, as our skilled hostess kept dinner conversation light and free of controversy. After the meal, I was disappointed to learn that dancing was cancelled. Instead, we were led into a large parlor off of the dining room where chess and backgammon were set up. As a child, I'd become quite skilled at these games, so I readily took a seat, and the rest of the evening passed pleasantly enough. Because of Mrs. Carden's sponsorship, invitations from her friends followed, and as they served as a distraction from my loneliness, I began to attend. Most of these evenings followed the same pattern. Guests were liberally doused with spirit as elaborate meals were presented. Because more liquor was served later in the drawing rooms, the games that then took place were enjoyed more freely than they might have been otherwise. Occasionally, a small orchestra provided music for dancing, and in this way I put to good use the skills that my instructor had taught. But it was over cards or backgammon that the more intense flirtations abounded. And when Mrs. Carden was in attendance, her attention was always on me. More than once she hinted at her availability, but I skirted the issue. And because there was no outright rejection, she did not appear to take offense as she had that day back in the silver shop. Curiously, it was she who introduced me to eligible women, and it seemed that she took perverse pleasure in their interest in me. Some of these women caught my eye, and the more forward of them maneuvered to be alone with me to offer up a kiss or two. A few offered more. And though I participated, I did not push for these interludes. I had not forgotten who I was, nor what was at stake. But I was a healthy man, and the frustrations that followed were uncomfortable. In time, I learned through the men who gathered in the smoke-filled drawing rooms for heartier drink and easier talk that houses existed where men could visit to relieve themselves of this primal tension. I gave some thought to it, but afraid of disease, I stayed away. Though as the next few years passed, I began to give the possibility more consideration. Then in the summer of 1828, I met Caroline, Mrs. Carden's daughter. It was at a dinner hosted by a close friend of Mrs. Carden's to welcome Caroline and her husband home after the years they had spent traveling abroad. Only 20 or so had been invited to the dinner, held prior to a large reception. Though the dinner number was restricted, I was accustomed, as an eligible man, to being included when seats were at a premium. I had been to this home before, and though it was not as grand as the Carden residence, few were, this one had a large drawing room that opened to a magnificent rose garden. It was a mild June evening, and dinner was served outdoors in the lush blooming garden, where hundreds of suspended candles and lanterns flickered in the twilight. When the guests of honor arrived, they were too late for introductions, and we were all seated immediately as the reception was soon to follow. Caroline's husband, Mr. Thomas Preston, took his seat across from me, and as he nervously adjusted his spectacles on his long, thin nose, he acknowledged those around with a stiff nod of greeting. His neck was restrained by an exceptionally tall white shirt collar and held in place by a wide cravat, and when the woman seated next to him complimented him on what was referred to as his European fashion, his pale, narrow face flushed with pleasure. Caroline was seated farther down, so I didn't take notice of her right away. But what I did note was that before we had finished the vichyssoise, Mr. Preston had already consumed more than enough wine. It wasn't until the oysters were served that I looked down the table and saw Caroline. I had been looking forward to meeting her, expecting to see a younger version of her mother, but how wrong I was. Though Mrs. Carden was handsome enough, her daughter was a true beauty. Dressed in a pale gray blue silk, Caroline leaned in to better hear the man seated next to her. And when she tilted her head up in my direction, her dark blue eyes locked on mine. I stared, and when she offered a slight smile, I became flustered and turned away. Had she taken me for someone else? Unable to deny myself another look, I turned back. Still in conversation, she again met my gaze, and she repeated her sweet smile. A toast was offered, and when she lifted her glass of wine, her long fingers cupped the bowl so gracefully that I found I was again staring and forced myself to look away. With some guilt, I looked to her husband, but his attention was on having his wine glass refilled. With dinner over and the dancing begun, Mrs. Carden brought over her daughter and son-in-law for introduction. She scarcely had time to present them before a small crisis occurred and the hostess sent word for Mrs. Carden's assistance. As she left to give her help, Mr. Preston mumbled something unintelligible, and then he, too, swayed off, leaving Caroline alone with me. "I apologize for my husband's behavior,"
she said. Close up, she was even more beautiful, and I struggled to make conversation.
I am sure coming home is an adjustment, I said, offering her an excuse.
Yes, she said. He hated to return.
And you?
I never wanted to leave home in the first place, she said.
You didn't?
How vulnerable she looked as she stared up at me. I had asked too intimate a question, and I tried to think of something else to say.
Might I ask if you had opportunity to use the vinaigrette I fashioned for your birthday?
Forgive me, I meant to mention it first thing after I recognized you at dinner.
But we've never met.
No, but your eye... She caught herself. I'm sorry, that was unkind.
Don't be sorry, I'm quite used to it, and I suppose it is a distinctive enough feature.
It is, she replied honestly, then adeptly changed course. Please know how I treasure my vinaigrette. It is a true work of art.
Thank you, I said.
You also paint?
How did you know? I asked.
Did you not paint that beautiful miniature of a cockatoo? The one mother has?
Oh, yes. Yes, I did, I said.
It is so tiny, yet so detailed. I've studied it many times. However did you achieve it?
Instead of a sable brush, I used a pin feather, I said, surprised at her interest.
You painted it with a pin feather? Of a bird?
Yes, it is a very old craft.
And where do you find these pin feathers?
Hunters shoot woodcock as game and bring them to the market. Through the winter months, I purchase all I need.
How remarkable. In England, I heard of a woman who used a bird's pin feather to paint on ivory.
You did? I must tell Mr. Leeds, my art instructor. He believes it is a lost art.
Mr. Leeds is your instructor? Perhaps he will teach me as well.
I'm afraid he has grown old and no longer teaches.
She was so breathtakingly beautiful, and I was so drawn to her that her nearness felt dangerous to me. Oh, she said. How unfortunate for me.
She tilted her head while her fingers played with a small curl that hung to the back of her neck.
Might you consider giving me a few classes?
She smiled with her full pink lips, and though I knew the danger, I was lost. When would you like to begin? I answered so quickly that Caroline laughed, as did I.
Perhaps in a few months? I should have my house in order by then, Caroline said, just as her mother, panting and short of breath, rejoined us. Your husband is holding forth and he is quite inebriated, Mrs. Carden scolded. Yes, I'm sure he is, Mother, said Caroline.
Mrs. Carden pursed her lips and stared back in the direction of Mr. Preston.
Mother, Caroline went on brightly, Mr. Burton has agreed to give me some painting instructions.
Mrs. Carden turned her attention toward us and assumed a smile.
Oh, darling, she said, when will you find the time? You have your home to set up. Mr. Burton has agreed to wait until the fall. By then everyone will be tired of seeing me, and I shall have something to look forward to when the snow comes.
Mrs. Carden patted her daughter's arm.
Well, if it is an art class that will make you happy, then we must find you an art instructor. Mr. Burton is a busy man. Surely you won't impose on his time.
He already has agreed, haven't you, Mr. Burton? Caroline smiled up at me. Caught in the crossfire, I had no choice but to agree with Caroline.
I see.
Mrs. Carden looped her arm through her daughter's and flashed me a smile that lacked warmth.
You will excuse us, Mr. Burton. Others have yet to greet Caroline.
Naturally, I said. And after they walked away, I soon left for home, where I tried to make sense of this uncomfortable fascination I felt for Mrs. Preston.
Chapter 16 1828 Caroline. For weeks I vacillated over sending a note to Mr. Burton reminding him of the art classes, until one day we met by chance. Early in October, I agreed to accompany Mother and her gardener Phelps to visit the greenhouses at Bartram's Gardens, but on the morning of our intended visit, Mother was struck with headache and had to forego the trip. It was a lovely day, and as I knew the place, I decided rather than spending the afternoon alone, I would accompany Phelps. I packed my sketch pad with the idea that I would visit the gardens while our gardener went about his business and made his selections. Phelps and I were easy company on the carriage ride over. I had known him all my life, and he had always been my most reliable source for botanical questions. He laughed still in remembrance of the time when, as a child, I asked if the wings of his dark mustache were meant to attract butterflies. On our arrival, as planned, Phelps went to the numerous greenhouses and hothouses, while I took to the gardens. It was a Tuesday, and there were few about as I ambled through the red and yellow gardens of dahlias and chrysanthemums. When I saw the river, I felt something akin to joy, and hurried toward the blue water. The air was still summer warm, and as I approached the shade of the maple and dogwood trees and saw no one about, I removed my hat. My new maid, try as she might, had no talent for dressing my hair. The pins were too tight, and I sighed with relief as I pulled them out and swung my hair loose. When I felt a tickle on my neck, I rubbed at it, only to hear the buzz of an angry bee. My reaction was involuntary when, afraid of a sting, I swatted it, and then fingered it from the tangle of my hair. "Oh, no," I said aloud when I found that I had killed it, for I had a particular affinity to bees. I wrapped the bee in my white handkerchief, meaning to take it home. But as I was doing so, a stern voice startled me.
"And what might you be doing?"
I swung around only to be met with Mr. Burton's teasing smile. "Oh, it's you," I said in surprise.
"So, Mrs. Preston, what have I found you illegally pocketing?" he asked.
His playfulness unnerved me, and when I fanned my face with my hat, my handkerchief dropped. He stooped to pick it up. "Be careful," I said. "It will fall out."
"And might I ask what treasure it holds?"
"It holds a bee. I killed it accidentally."
"You killed it? And why would you do that? I happen to fancy bees."
"It was in my hair," I explained.
"Oh, dear. Did it sting you?"
I fingered my neck. "No," I said, "but I was afraid that it might. I should not have removed my hat."
"And why did you?" he asked, his manner playful.
"Because my pins were pinching," I said.
"Mrs. Preston, seen in Bartram's Gardens with her hat off. I can see the newspaper headline now. The scandal of it."
I laughed, and so did he.
"I was sitting over there under that pine," he said, pointing to a bench. "Would you care to join me?"
I had no reason not to do so, and after he lifted a sketchpad to make room for me, we sat together in silence, looking out over the water.
"Mrs. Preston?"
"Yes?"
"Why exactly are you keeping the bee?"
"I am taking it home to sketch it."
"I see."
"I would not intentionally kill a bee, but now that I have, I don't want to waste the opportunity to use it."
"And what is your process?"
"Well, I'll study it first, the color, you know, and then I'll paint it. But first I'll draw it over and over until I get the details right."
"Ah," he said. "Like this?"
He picked up his sketchpad and flipped it open to a page filled with quick sketches of a common sparrow. "May I page through?" I asked. He handed the pad over, and as I leafed through, I was curious to see it filled with sketches, not only of birds, as I had expected, but of pine cones and acorns, and a multitude of various leaves and branches. I asked him the purpose of this.
"I hope one day to produce a small book of bird illustrations. If I am to authentically represent birds, then I must realistically display them in their natural habitat."
"And your book would include our local birds?" I asked.
"No. My idea is to provide a handbook as a reference for those traveling down along the eastern coastline."
"How wonderful! Is there one bird that particularly interests you?"
"I must say that I am drawn to the Carolina parakeet."
"Oh, I love parakeets," I said.
"I know," he said, and his smile was so genuine that I looked away. "Your vinaigrette?" he reminded me.
"Of course," I said, and, embarrassed at my forgetfulness, I steered the conversation away. "Will your books be for sale?"
"I'm afraid I am far from that," he answered. "Getting it into print is a very expensive proposition."
I would be the first to purchase one, I said, and he laughed at my enthusiasm. Again, we looked out at the water. It took me a while to work up the courage before I addressed him. Mr. Burton?
Yes.
I must ask, are you still willing to teach me how to paint with a pin feather? He picked away a golden leaf that had fallen on his jacket sleeve.
I wondered if you were still interested, he said.
Oh, yes, but I didn't want to impose on your time.
I already teach a class on Saturday morning. It is in watercolor. Your medium?
He asked, and I nodded.
Good, he said. But the students use traditional brushes. If you would like, you might join that class. We can see how you do and then proceed from there.
That would be wonderful, I said, but held tight to my excitement.
I have one hesitation, he said.
I leaned over to better see his face. And what is that?
I'm afraid that it has to do with your mother. I sensed she had an objection.
I sat back. I am not a child, and I do not need her permission. When he laughed, his face wrinkled in a most pleasant way.
No, you are not a child. Quite the opposite, he said. But I'm afraid that I was only thinking of protecting myself. Your mother can be quite formidable.
It was my turn to laugh. Leave her to me, Mr. Burton, I said. I will see to it that you come through this unscathed. Chapter 17 1828-1829 Caroline. On a Saturday morning, at the early hour of 10 o'clock, I entered the foyer of Mr. Burton's home. There, to my dismay, I discovered that I was the only woman attending his class, and that the three other young male students were from the university. I felt so intimidated that I would have left had not Robert, the butler, already begun to lead our small group up the stairwell. As we made our way through the rather dark house, my tension increased. What had I done? What had I been thinking? I was getting ready to bolt when Robert ushered us into a room so charming that at once I relaxed. The walls were painted my favorite shade of yellow, and when Robert drew back the blue and white draperies, light filled the room. It streamed onto an old pine table loaded down with pints of water, glass jars filled with upended brushes, ceramic palettes, and boxes of paint cubes. Heaven! The other students, after selecting supplies, made their way to the easels. As I moved in and gaped about, I tripped on the heavy canvas cloth that covered the dark oak floor. But I saved myself when I grabbed hold of the fireplace mantle. In an effort to cover my clumsiness, I leaned in to smell the sweet fragrance of the yellow roses that poked out from the fingers of a quintal. At that moment, Mr. Burton entered with a large white cockatoo perched on his shoulder. Previously, I had been as curious as any about his black eye patch, but this day it only lent to his handsomeness. He was a tall man, well proportioned, and his close-fitting waistcoat, patterned in blue and black, was set off by his white shirt and his black cravat. I wished I had worn something more attractive than my dark navy day dress. He paused when he saw me, then turned toward the students when they hailed him. What he might have said or done next, I know not, for the entire room was distracted when his bird lifted off and flew to my shoulder. There, testing me, the bird gave a small nip to my ear. I tapped his beak, as I had learned to do with my own spoiled pet. No, I said in a firm tone. I don't like that. The bird cocked his head to look at me. Miffed that I had corrected him, he flew to a perch by the window and from there squawked out for all to hear, Naughty boy! You are a naughty boy, I said quickly, and all the young men laughed. Mr. Burton was not amused and came forward. Did he hurt you? He asked. No, I said, cupping my ear with my hand, for I guessed it was red. Mr. Burton looked uncertain. I'm fine, I reassured him. I am familiar with birds. I have Roger, my own parakeet. He too can be quite naughty, I said, smiling. Just then, a young colored boy entered the room carrying a large blue bowl of red and green apples. "Pan!" the students all greeted him enthusiastically, and his large brown eyes sparkled in response.
"Go ahead," Mr. Burton encouraged him,
and the boy carefully made his way to the front, where he placed the full bowl on a table set up to be used as a prop for a still life. Next to me, Mr. Burton spoke quietly.
"Mrs. Preston, if you would please take what you need from the table and go to an easel, our class will begin."
I feared I would not be skilled enough to keep up with my classmates, but in the weeks to follow, I was happy to see that I could hold my own. Meanwhile, though he knew of my earlier studies, Mr. Burton expressed surprise at my talent, and I privately reveled in his praise. However, I was disappointed to find that he was not the same man he had been that day in Bartram's Gardens. In the classroom, he held himself back, not only from me, but also from his students. Perhaps because of that, we all worked hard to earn his praise. The art class soon became the focus of my week. Here, I lost myself in the joy of painting, and the time flew by. Yet, it was not only art that drew me to Mr. Burton's home. At my home, Mr. Preston's comments about my art were so disparaging that I increasingly kept it from him. My marriage had failed so desperately that my husband and I scarcely managed civility with each other. Mr. Preston cared no more for me than I for him, and we had not been intimate since early on in the marriage, when I had found him in a compromised position with another man. However, bound together as we were, we continued to make the required social rounds, where his inevitable inebriation and resulting behavior left us both humiliated. At these affairs, Mr. Burton and I were cordial, though I was ever careful to hold myself at a distance. Yet there were moments during these events, inescapable moments when our eyes met, and what passed between us was so powerful that I was often left profoundly shaken. This tension, this draw, followed us into the classroom, but as it grew for me, he became more aloof. I held myself in check, but when I was away from him, I spent hours imagining that he longed for me as I did him. In those hours, I traced his mouth with my fingers and imagined his smile as he clasped my hand and then kissed me. Soon, gaining his attention became my focus, and my days were filled with the effort. I canceled some of my routine engagements with Mother and used my extra time to paint. At the same time, I found a new maid who was more skilled at dressing hair and could guide me with my clothing. The challenge of winning Mr. Burton's notice gave me new life, and with my happiness, my mother became curious. Some months later, Mother and I were in my carriage, returning from the shops. Squeezed between piles of boxes and packages, I was quiet while fingering the package on my lap that held my new blue shawl. I wondered if Mr. Burton would see how well the color suited my eyes.
"And how is your artwork progressing, dear?" Mother asked casually.
"Very well," I said, happy for the subject. "But I am impatient to begin working in miniature. I cannot wait. I only hope that when it comes time, I do not disappoint Mr. Burton."
"You must think well of Mr. Burton if you do not want to disappoint him."
"Oh, I do."
"He is a good instructor, then."
"I have never known better. He is so encouraging." I could not keep the warmth from my voice.
"Be careful, darling," she said, touching my hand.
"Of what, Mother?" In my guilt, I drew my hand back.
"You are a married woman," she said. "You do not yet have a child. Until you do, you must be especially careful of how you conduct yourself."
"What do you mean?"
"You know, darling, first the heir, then the affair."
"Mother, how horrible!"
"I know," she said, covering her mouth as she gave an embarrassed laugh. "It's just that I know your situation at home is not..."
"I've done nothing inappropriate. You forget. You yourself agreed that I should take the art class."
"Of course I did. I'm only suggesting..."
My guilt fed my anger, and I cut her short. I know what you are suggesting, Mother, and what you suggest insults me. How could you insinuate such a thing?
Caroline.